Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
This episode of Social Flight Live is made possible by Avemco Insurance. Mention Social Flight for a 5% insurance discount at Avemco.com, subject to terms and conditions.
Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at SocialFlightLive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have an amazing show for you this evening. Paul Jackson, chief pilot for Whip Air's advanced flight training business, is here. We're going to talk about his amazing personal story and explore one of the most fascinating types of adventure flying that there is. Before we get started, just a few things. Well, there are tens of thousands of events just booming in social flight, so be sure to check out socialflight.com and the free Social Flight mobile app for Apple and Android devices. Summer's not over yet, and as everything keeps going out there, you can find all of the fly-ins, all of the FAA learning events, all of the pancake breakfast, you name it, and especially float plane fly-ins given tonight's event. All of that is at socialflight.com. In addition to that, we have our Fly to Win Challenge, and we just gave away an Aspen E5 electronic flight instrument to our winner, Jody Earhart of Justin, Texas. She won that. Aspen E5 is going to be installing that. And right now we are giving away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. That prize is going to be given away on October 1st. There is no purchase necessary to win any of this. It's the app's free. Everything's free. Just go to get the Social Flight mobile app and check in for the Fly to Win Challenge at your local airport. And then if you can check in at more airports that you fly into, get more points, you'll get extra entries to win if you get on our leaderboard. Very, very cool things. Check all of that out. And then the last thing is that there is a ton of education if you go to socialflight.com or inside the mobile app. Go to the FAA credits section, and within that, you can find all sorts of courses for wings credits. If you're a mechanic, you can participate in the Aviation Maintenance Technician Awards program, or if you're an AMP with an inspection authorization, you can do your recurrent training right in Social Flight, completely free. All of those courses will issue you a certificate that you can use towards your 8 hours of continuing education. It's all there. Check it out. And there are some very cool courses from Whip Air that teach you about float plane maintenance, you can see really what goes into all these floats. It is super, super cool. Which brings us to tonight's sponsor, which is Whip Air and their amazing Whip Line line of floats. I have been to their factory in South St. Paul, and if you have a chance to do that, it is absolutely spectacular. Go there, get a tour, see how all of these cool floats are put together. And then they have so much more. They have avionics, paint, interior, maintenance, all of that is there. And you can even check out their brand new propeller that's done with Hartzell, where they have put on a caravan what is called the Yukon propeller. We're going to talk about that a little bit tonight as well. Now on to tonight's guest. Paul Jackson has over 28,000 hours of flight time in everything from J3 Cubs to Boeing airliners. But his true calling is the adventure of backcountry float plane flying. He operates his own seaplane base and fly-in camp in the Canadian wilderness. His float plane experience includes nearly everything that you can stick on top of a set of floats, from Piper Cubs, Cessnas, Davelin Beavers, Cessna Caravans, and Whip Air's incredible Fire Boss firefighting aircraft. In addition to float planes, Paul routinely flies warbirds ranging from his own 450 Stearman to the iconic P-51 Mustang. And I'll also add, if Paul looks familiar to you, it's probably because he was the co-host of the internationally distributed aviation TV show, The Flight Line. And so you'll get all the info on that. Go look that up. We'll give you some info on how you can go see those episodes. But instructing and creating a culture of safety are so important to Paul, and one of the biggest reasons that he's here with us tonight. He's a passionate flight instructor and mentor dedicated to making flying safer for everyone who shares our passion for aviation. And he pursues this passion in his role as chief pilot for advanced flight training as part of the Whip Air family. So with that, let me please welcome to Social Flight Live, Paul Jackson. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for the nice introduction.
Hey, thanks for taking the time.
I'm tired of just listening to that, man. I'm tired.
You fired up, right? You got to meet this guy.
Yeah. Jeez, holy smokes. I had no idea I did all that, but okay, good.
All true. You are very, very humble. And I was thrilled to get to spend a little bit of time with you at AirVenture this year. You were sitting there talking about the Fire Boss. We did a bunch of those cool things. But the more that I have gotten little tidbits about your life, the more intrigued I have become. And so I want to just dive right in here. Tell me how you got started in aviation, and then what also drove you towards this very unique part of that aviation community.
It started with my dad. I think everybody's got a great dad story. My dad got his pilot's license in 1940 and 1941 at the age of 16. And his goal was to turn 17 and then enlist, which he actually got the forms wrong. He had to be 18, but he was hoping to do it at 17 and sign up for the Royal Air Force up in Winnipeg. He was learning to fly at St. Paul Holman Field back before it was even Holman Field. And World War II interrupted. He became a mud marine, fought through the Pacific. Closest he got to an airplane was watching them strafe over his head as he made 5 amphibious assaults, several Purple Hearts. Later, he came home from the war, had a war baby right away, and then he had me as the last World War II baby ever born in the mid-60s, so I was the oops child. Dad took me to a lot of airports, a lot of fly-ins, the old pay-for-the-pound rides at the 4th of July up in Moose Lake, Minnesota, where my mom was from, and just was around aviation. But where it really started was college. And I got in with a great group of guys, and I still talk to them. They're still my best friends. And we had what was called the St. Cloud State Aero Club, and literally started in 1947 when a guy came home from the war, and they purchased a Champ and started a flying club. And by the time I got there, we had our own 10-place hangar. We had Skyhawks and 152s, and we babied them. That's where I learned to take care of airplanes. I like to think that's where I learned to own airplanes. Friday nights, we didn't go to the bar and drink beer every night. Every Friday, we went out and drank beer and washed airplanes and washed the bugs off them, cleaned them up, hung out with each other. And what I really learned was it wasn't about how much money you had, it was about the passion you had. And that group of goofballs and I went on, and some of them are high up in airlines, some of them are airline captains, some of them went into other fields, some of them are recreational pilots. But to this day, we first went to Oshkosh, I believe, 1985, and pretty much have gone together ever since, almost every year, some form or fashion, that group has gotten together and gone. And that's where it really started. From there, I went and flew, graduated, got my CFI, did a little flight instructing, flew a little bit of freight, ended up a little regional airline, or when they called them commuter airlines back in the day, flying Beech 99, square-windowed King Airs, in and out of O'Hare 3-4 times a day for Great Lakes Airlines, and was lucky enough to upgrade as the airline grew at a real young age, and then moved on and out of there, and kind of was the last guy at Great Lakes, one of the last guys at Great Lakes to get hired out of the airline before the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, and 1991. Went to America West, enjoyed America West. It was great, but America West didn't like.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you. And most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Didn't like having so many of us around. They bought two 747s that didn't pan out very well, and a whole bunch of us got furloughed. So got to experience that in my career early on. Ended up flying for a company out of Tucson, got a job there, flying the Bureau of Land Management firefighters around, which comes full circle to what I'm doing now. But worked with the BLM a lot, flew for a charter company out of Salt Lake City that ended up turning into an airline called Morris Air. And was lucky enough, I was a captain there. We had about 250 pilots, 225 pilots, somewhere in there. And I was like number 18, just happened to be in the right place. Made captain at a very, very young age on the 7-3. And then we were purchased by Southwest. And then I had a long career at Southwest from there. That's the airline professional side of it. Southwest was a real great ride. I got to ride it just like I did other airlines, from a small airline with 1,500 pilots all the way up when I retired. We had over 11,000. So
tell me a little bit about your freight time, because that's, you know, usually the people I've met who are have some freight dog in their history have an awful lot of good stories.
Yeah. I went out to upstate New York, and it was another, I don't know if you, there was a computer company in town called Control Data, and there was a flight instructor who worked for Control Data. And one day he had a very major midlife crisis, and he walked in and quit at Control Data. And then he came out to the airport and looked at me and said, "Hey, I'm starting a freight operation in upstate New York, and I got a contract. You want to come fly for me?" And I was sitting around reading a magazine, not flying a whole bunch in January. And I went, "Yeah, that sounds great. Let's go do it." So I went to upstate New York, Utica, New York, based in Utica. He leased an A36 Bonanza with no boots on it. And I ended up flying in upstate New York in the middle of winter with no boots, eating an apple and learning a lot about icing. There's probably a lot of rules out there that were approached and broached in a lot of those flights at night, but survived that. It was interesting. And while I was out there, and a resume I put out to Great Lakes Airlines popped up on somebody's desk, and I ended up leaving the freight world pretty quick before it got me. So yeah, flying freight at night. I remember eating an apple and looking out the window at the wing very cautiously and going, never seen that before. Eat my apple. And I'm like, well, there's more of it out there. And I keep screwing the power in. And pretty soon I'm going down the ILS, and I said, I don't think I'm going to put the gear out right away on this one. I think we'll wait for the gear. It seems to be going right down the glide slope without any problem at all, without the gear. So yeah, there were a couple of nights that were fun. You know, I'm really glad the equipment is a lot better for the younger guys today when they start out. Those Beach 99s we had at Great Lakes, a lot of that stuff was pretty underpowered and pretty overweight. And, you know, we were pushing torque all the time and temping out and doing those things. And now they get a job at a regional and they jump into a, you know, RJ, and they wonder if the coffee maker works, you know. So it's a little different world they live in than back in the day when I did it. So
it's kind of like the days of the giants, right, that you hear people talking about. There's a little less of that these days, but there certainly is that, you know, pre-moving map world of flying and really understanding what needles did in all that. I will say, I always find it kind of interesting that there was one upside to all of that, and that is you could go from cockpit to cockpit without a huge training. You know, you knew what you were getting. It was either Narco or King, and you were just putting a frequency in and looking at needles, and they worked, and that was it. Now, of course, you know, you got to be a computer expert.
I can't fly anymore, but can I type? Yeah, I mean, the Beach 99, you know, our biggest fear was when they took out the terrorist-proof curtains, you know, which we used to have a little curtain behind the seat, and I don't know what happened at Great Lakes, but one day they took all of them out, and pretty much it became a team effort when we had the radar in the middle and we'd be flying towards Waterloo, Iowa, and there'd be a big line of weather and the radar would be there, and you'd start playing with the tilt a little bit, and then you'd kind of look over your left shoulder a little bit and everybody's leaning in the aisle looking at the radar. So you had a bunch of assistant radar operators there, and then flew with some great captains when I was young, and then I ended up being a very, very young captain there. And I moved to the 1900 pretty quick after I upgraded, which was a absolute spectacular upgrade from the 99. And really, to this day, it's one of my favorite airplanes, that 1900. Way overpowered.
Really?
Oh, yes. Just a.
I always heard people say they had to muscle that thing around. Like,
yeah, it didn't have an autopilot and stuff. But it had a great big trim wheel, which you could just sit and hold that trim wheel. And it had more torque than it needed. It had the engines were way derated on it, had big old paddle blade props on it. Could not get it overweight and couldn't get it out of CG. It was just such a good airplane.
Wow.
And it didn't have any pushers, had nothing on it. Did have some weird stuff hanging on it there, but he teased us about. But
yes,
no, that was a great airplane.
Yeah. For anyone out there who needs to, go look up a Beech 1900 and take a look, because it's almost like they did it and it's like, nope, still yaws. Okay, well, let me put these little strakes on the bottom. How about now? Nah, still wiggles. Okay, let me put little other things on the outside of the horizontal stabilizers. How about now? I don't know. They just kept putting stuff on it.
Yeah. And it was funny too, because you'd pre-flight, there was more stuff to hit yourself on, so there was stuff hanging all over that airplane. But I mean, I had one time where we had an engine out, and they put an engine in the back of the airplane with a forklift and slid it in there. And I went and carried 19 people. I'm well within weight and balance and well within CG. I couldn't take a full bag of gas, but we were able to haul an engine and do a revenue flight. You know, we'd have to put their bags aft, bag aft, but it was just a neat airplane to fly. And it kind of spoiled you. I mean, it really was a way ahead of its time airplane. And it's kind of sad, because that it isn't that the airplane went away, it's that the market went away. That 19 seat world went away. ES, top of the bottom theaters and all that.
So, yeah. Well, we're here to talk about float plane flying, and I don't want to miss out on that time. So tell me how you got introduced to the idea that you didn't always have to be landing at an airport with a coffee shop.
Yeah. So I mentioned St. Cloud State, where I learned to fly, up in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And there was a guy up there named Claire Wesley. And Claire was a character. He was probably one of the top Cessna salesmen in the country. And there wasn't a float plane he couldn't fly. And Claire, I was a lineman there, and Claire took a shine to me, and I got to ride with Claire more than a couple times, and got to be around float planes a lot. Didn't get my float rating, but flew a lot of float planes with Claire. And what I learned from Claire was the beauty of the float plane was that it did take you anywhere. It was backcountry flying, and Claire had that just smirk on his face all the time. We'd go out and do different things. We had a ditch cut next to the runway, and we'd come in straight floats and land in that ditch, and then they'd pick us up with a winch and drop us on the grass, and then we'd go pick up another person's airplane outside the airport and then fly it in and land in the ditch. And Claire kept telling me, you need to get your float rating so I don't have to do this. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. The ditch was just barely wider than the floats, but I did learn float plane flying up there to love it. Later in life, I ended up after Great Lakes, and when I was at the airlines, I did just subsidize my income. I started an aircraft sales company and did a few things like that, and started hanging around. And one of my buddies was a float plane guy, and he was at South St. Paul, had an aircraft sales company over there. And he said, hey, what are you doing this weekend? And I said, nothing. I luckily got the weekend off. And he's like, yeah, we're going to Canada. And I got invited to go with this group, this gaggle, and it was pretty much anything with floats on it. And it was guys with a Super Cub on straights would take off out of the base. Another guy with Super Cubs and amphibs would take off. Another guy, Mark Matheson, who was the chief pilot of Whipper at the time, would let him take a Beaver, and he'd grab a Beaver, and we'd all crawl in. And I started hanging out with these guys. And what I was a problem. I was weight. I was the guy standing there looking to hop in with somebody and go. And finally, it dawned on me one day I should probably try to buy my own float plane. And at that point in life, I'd gotten into general aviation again more, had owned an experimental and was still going to Oshkosh and still had my dreams and whatever. But one of the airplanes I first bought was the first thing I did was I rented from somebody and basically bought a block of time in a PA-12. And that really taught me that you could go to Canada. I brought my boys and my two young kids at the time and did our stuff. Then I went out and bought a 185. And that's when I transitioned from being a problem to being a solution. Now I had a seat or extra seats, or I could carry food or weight or anything like that. And we started going up to Canada. When we started, we just made friends with the outfitters. And the famous line was fish camp doesn't just happen. So we always had Wednesday night was fish camp planning night. So we get together and cook up fish from the last week or two that we had. And we talk about where we'd go, and we'd get on the cell phone and we'd talk to our outfitter buddies up north, and they'd give us a vacant camp. $50 a guy cash just for an empty camp. They didn't have to fly us in, and we just used their camp. And that's pretty much how it started. And that gaggle of guys, again, just like my St. Cloud State guys, and everybody has these groups, it's still around. We've been decimated by age and time, but we still, I took a caravan last year and took about, you know, we had about 8 of them in my camp up in Canada last year of that original group. So it's great. But that's kind of how it started, was just kind of hanging around guys that use their float planes. So that's how it starts usually.
And tell everyone a little bit about what that really entails, so people get a sense of the, whether it's the camping, the fishing, the other aspect of it. What's it really mean when you guys go up and hit one of those lakes and hang out there?
Well, and like I said, fish camp doesn't just happen. So there was a legendary yellow piece of legal paper that one of my buddies had, and it had the number of days on the side, or the food objects on the left, and the number of days on the side. And then it had a cross reference on the bottom where you'd look and you'd say, 3 days, 6 guys, we need 4 big containers of oil. And then we'd put them in the cart. And that's how it started on Wednesday. We would go shopping. And I'm not kidding. The last day you'd pour that last drop of oil to make that last bit of fish. But we always brought our ceremonial bag of lettuce. We always brought 2 bags of lettuce, pre-made salad, never ate them, burned those on Sunday before we came back at our ceremonial lettuce burning. And we would do that. But the planning of it was, back in the day, was, you know, was it. The other was the navigation piece of it back in the day was really funny, because we would call up a great guy like Dave Bouchan, and he says, yeah, you can go to my, you know, my camp on Rowan Lake. Oh, okay, we're going to Rowan Lake. And we'd get out our map, and if you look up there, there's more than a couple lakes up there, and they all have different shapes. And one guy's in the lead, and I can recall sitting in my float plane, and back in the early days of GPS, with a guy standing in front of me while I was waiting for oil temp, going 4, 6, 1, 9, and putting in the lat longs for the lake that we're going to. And hopefully, but we did find out more than once, or actually just once, actually. We called the outfitter the week after and said, hey, you know, thanks for the camp. That was really great. Did you get, you know, we left cash there and whatever. And he goes, you know, I just went to the camp. You guys didn't go. We went to the wrong camp. Somebody had about,
well, someone got cash.
Yeah, we don't know if it was a private camp or it was a public camp, but somebody had $400 cash sitting there, and we used some of their propane and some of their boat gas and ran their boats around and caught fish. And we really thought we were on this lake and we were on another lake, but in the end it really didn't hurt anything, so it worked out. But the airplanes, you know, you got to make sure your airplane's working. We seem to always bring mechanics from Whip Air. I've seen engines changed off trees, hanging off of trees. We've done many different things and whatnot on maintenance. But when you get up there, the other is your plan for keeps up there. And, you know, we, over the years, accumulated a lot of things. We carried a very serious medical kit with sutures in it and stitches and different things. We back in the day, we carried a really good sat phone back in the day. I won't tell you now because I watched Netflix at my place in Canada this weekend, so we don't need the sat phone. but we carried a sat phone, and then EPIRBs came, and we all got EPIRBs. We all carried our, you know, our life vests. But what's funny about it, when you say, what's it like when you go up there? Well, most people say, well, I go to Canada, and they drive or they fly, and then an outfitter flies them in, and they get out, and they put their groceries away, and then they stare at each other, and then they look at fishing, and they go out and they fish, and then they come back in and they clean their fish, and then they look at each other and they do these things. Well, we have two parts of the day. We have flying part of the day, which is before happy hour, and then happy hour, and then all the flying stops. Obviously, we have to stop flying. So before, we have had lawn chairs along the shoreline with big numbers, with Super Cubs and 180s and different things making flybys. Then the outfitters would come by, because we know all the outfitters and their pilots, and they'd make flybys, and we'd hold up numbers and everybody have their giggle. We did a lot of remote flying, where we'd go out from the lake we're on. Why would you leave a perfectly good walleye lake to go to another walleye lake? Well, the answer is because you can. And I carried a little 5-horse motor with a backpack strap, little outboard with a fuel integral. A lot of guys just fish off their airplane. We did that this weekend. I can tell you that story if you want to hear it. But anyhow, it's just, you just go up there and you're kind of playing for keeps, but you've got to have the equipment. You got to be prepared, but we're different. We don't just go up there and fish. We fly, you know, we got up there Friday. I'll tell you this story. We went up this weekend. Guy just built a Javron PA-12 Cub, just beautiful. And he wanted to take his airplane. He was so excited because he's done with it now. First Canada trip for him. My other buddy's got a new girlfriend. He wanted to show her, which is like bringing a sandwich to a buffet. It doesn't make any sense, but he brought her. And then I don't have any friends left that are alive, so I just went by myself. Actually, I had a lot of work to do, and I didn't want to bring somebody else and do just work because I didn't even know if I was going to fish because I had so much work at camp to do. So we all went up separately and ended up crossing the border. We keep a car in Fort Francis. They went and got groceries with his lady friend, and so that was nice. They overbought food again. I went up to camp, and of course they get there, and I'm doing my thing and, you know, getting ready to do some work and whatever. And he comes over and he's got a glint in his eye, and he's like, "Hey, I know where there's a really good crappie lake north of here, up by past my camp." And I go, "Oh, okay. Well, keep in mind, I just flew my 180 about 2 hours, and you know, not quite 2 hours, but I did a border crossing and a takeoff and whatever." And I'm not out of gas, but I'm like, "Eh, you know, his camp is 15 miles north of me. I can go up there and back, and we keep a little gas in camp, and Fort Francis is not that far away." So anyhow, we get everybody loaded up. And we could all ride in one airplane. We could all fit in my airplane almost, but no, everybody's got to take their airplane. So we take off, and we're immediately, you know, in our little loose gaggle of formation, and we start flying to the north and west. And about 15, 20 minutes in, I kind of went, I don't have a lot of gas. This is kind of farther than I thought it'd be. Oh, it's just up here. You know, everybody's got the buddy, you know, who just says it's just up here. No, you know, we have all the GPSs and the moving maps in the world. None of us know where we're going except for him. And he's flying and he's kind of weaving and showing his girlfriend all this stuff. And I'm like, I need to get to this lake. And I'm like, all right, I'm getting to the point now. I said, "Hey, do they sell gas in Nestor Falls?" No, they don't sell gas there. That airport doesn't even have a fuel pump. I said, "Oh, maybe I'll stop at one of the outfitters and get gas on the way back." "Oh, they're probably gone. It'll be late when we get back." And he's kind of poo-pooing me. And he says, "Oh, I got a couple gallons in my airplane, in my float." And I usually carry gas in my float. And I had taken it out because I wanted to use it for the lawnmower and other things. So anyhow, we land. And I look at him and I go, "Dude, seriously, we just went like 35, 40 minutes. And I'm in a 180. And I just flew 2 hours up here. I can do math. And I have a fuel totalizer and have all these things. My fuel totalizer acts up a little bit. And I'm like, I can make it back, but it's going to be a little bit tight. I don't like pushing gas." And he said, "Well, I'll give you 5 gallons. And I said, "How much you got?" And he says, "Well, I've got 10. I said, "I'm getting all of it." And he said, "Well, I might need the 5. And I said, "No, you're the one who drugged me to a crappie lake that you said was just a little bit of ways. I'm taking all your gas." So I went into I went over and beached it on shore, you know, took my shoes and socks off, got wet, got the fuel bags, crawled up on top of the wing. And I don't have to do this. This was just dumb. I mean, I could have pumped 20 gallons at my own camp, but I thought we were only going 10 minutes, but we're going. So anyhow, I put it in and lived to tell the tale. But that's pretty much the pinnacle of flight planning in Canada right there. But anyhow, that's kind of the stuff that happens. We go up there. We fly a lot. We fly to remote places. We go to different places. We beach the airplane. Sometimes, don't tell the Ontario Department of Resources because they frown on it, but every once in a while we might find a boat in the woods that just happens to be there, and we put a motor on it and go fish. Those are illegal. You can't do that. We don't do
that. Why can't you do that?
I don't know. There's a rule against it. They're called throw boats, and there's a rule against that. Not that I've ever used one, but I have.
You're not allowed to have a boat with a motor?
No, you're not allowed to leave a boat on a remote lake like Stowe.
Oh.
So.
Oh.
But we don't.
So as long as you brought the boat up in your plane, you're good.
Right, right. What I end up doing, what we end up doing is we end up finding boats in the woods randomly, and then we utilize them.
People leave boats all over the place. That makes perfect sense.
A lot of those people will give you a pin and they will drop them and tell you where they are just in case. And they also do the same thing with fish, portable fish fryers and everything, so you can eat. So really good. So.
Anyway. Well, I want people to see this. This is your camp, right?
Yeah, that's my camp with my partner. That is right at sunset. We were coming in. If you look to the left there, that's the caravan I fly contract. nine November X-ray, beautiful old serial number, like 188. It's a 1988 straight caravan 208 on whip 8000s. And the gentleman that owns that, I manage that airplane for him, and then I fly it contract for him, and then I horse trade him for time in that airplane to go up and back and forth to Canada in it. So it works well. My 180 is very jealous. It sits in the hangar and makes faces as I taxi by in the turbine power. But if I take somebody, if I take four, five, six guys up, it's a wonderful way to get up there. But yeah, that's the island. That's our little bay where we park right there.
That's pretty spectacular. And I also, it did not go unnoticed that you just said that you horse trade for time in a caravan.
Yes, I sell my I sell myself. We all know what we are. We're negotiating on price. So yeah.
I love that. There's a couple more I think you had here that show a little bit more of this.
That's my 180 very happily on the left there, and that's actually this weekend, and that's the Javron Cub and the rear end of the PA-12. That's a 180 horse PA-12, probably two of the nicest PA-12s I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of PA-12s. That's our dock, and that's kind of looking the opposite way there, off of the shot that you just had. So for sure.
That's really spectacular, and I've got a couple more to share here as well. I mean, how do you beat something like this?
Yeah, that's we call that Sally's Borealis. Yes, Sally puts on a show. Yeah, that was a weekend last summer, and it is amazing. The loons go crazy when the northern lights go like that. You can literally read by those northern lights. It was so bright that night. They're just beautiful up there. And they'll dance.
What do you mean the balloons? What did you say goes crazy?
The loons. They get light and they get all spooked by the fact that it's so bright out.
Really?
They just go crazy. Yeah, they keep you up. Hard to sleep with loons and northern lights. It's terrible. That's a beaver that is based out of Grand Rapids. A friend of mine has on floats that shall go nameless that rhyme with Aeroset. And that's pretty much what we brought right there. That just shows you how much that beaver will carry. There were four of us and a lot of supplies. And that thing is absolutely a workhorse. Nice hydromatic two blade on it, on a set of straight floats. So it doesn't give up much for gross weight. And just a really good straight flying beaver. Extended cabin there. See the two windows, it's extended cabin. I just love that beaver. It's a friend of mine's.
It is. It's pretty wild. I mean, you know, we've had John Nordstrom was on the show. He's a huge, you know, a beaver on floats guy, has two of them. Kenny G was on the show. He's also obviously got a beaver on floats. That seems to be a little magic combination for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's
Jimmy Graham has one.
Yeah. They're amazing. And it is funny because we, you know, I work with a shop quite a bit, Two Brothers Aviation in South St. Paul, and they rebuild beavers and they'll build them up from projects, and then they'll do a lot of cabin extensions and things. A lot of stuff Whip Air does still, but gets subcontracted out to smaller vendors now as Whip's moved on to fire bosses and big airplanes. But Whip still does a lot of beaver work. So, for instance, I just did an intake flight on a beaver on wheels that Whip's going to float on brand new floats. To this day, we're still floating beavers on brand new sets of floats. And the next generation of floats is really nice compared to the originals. A lot better gear systems. You know, rather than a two-way pump that pump with two sets of hoses, it's got a bi-directional pump. Little bit of weight savings, not marked. I mean, when you're talking about a beaver, 75 pounds isn't much, but, you know, on a float plane, it still is. But they're nice. But, yeah, I'm around a lot of beavers. And I get to fly a lot of them. That there's one that I think I've got a picture of in there that is owned by an individual out of Phoenix. Everyone in Phoenix should have a float plane, but he comes up to Minnesota, and I babysit and manage that airplane for him, and keep it running and beans and coffee and keep it exercised. So it's been to Canada a couple times.
That's awesome. And then the last one, of course, from up there. How spectacular is this one? You can just land anywhere you want.
Yeah, that's our camp right there, right? That little island right there in the middle. If you look at that bay, kind of drag your mouse down a little bit, right there is our bay. But that's about a 9.5-10 mile lake. We bought the place sight unseen during COVID. The owner of it had lost a partner to cancer. Turned out, I know the guy, and he's a local guy, and he had done a yeoman's job of carrying the camp on as a commercial camp. We bought it as a commercial camp, and we've done a lot of work to it and restoration to keep it going. And we go up there, try to get up there a couple times a month between my partner and I. My partner's got his own beaver that he flies up there. Interestingly enough, I just helped him get a seaplane base on Lake Vermilion. He's got a seaplane base at his cabin on Lake Vermilion. So there's only one thing dumber than owning a cabin, that's owning two. So I have one I have my seaplane base in McGregor. He's got his in Vermilion. Mine's in McGregor, Minnesota. And it works out really nice for both of us. We have the seaplane base and the place in Canada. So it works out really good for both of us. We're very blessed.
That really is. So tell me a little bit about that. Tell me what's involved in like the world of seaplane bases.
So this seaplane base,
how you wound up with it.
Seaplane bases are like airplanes. They find you apparently. This one found me. I was standing in the hangar. I had a P Baron at the time that I was test flying, and a kid walked in and he said, "Hey, my uncle's old seaplane base is coming on the market. You know anybody looking for a seaplane base?" And I'm always the guy, "Hey, who wouldn't be, kind of whatever." And then it turned out we needed a test flight. And I said, "Why don't you call your realtor? I want to see that place." And we ended up flying up to McGregor, Minnesota, a little quick flight in the Baron, landed. Real estate guy took us over there, met the guy, crotchety old guy, and he walks up and he walked me around. Of course, I went down immediately, looked at the hangar, which I've got a picture of on there. And then I didn't care to look at the cabin. I just wanted to look at the hangar. And we started talking numbers a little bit, and he said, "I'm going to put it on the market." And I looked at it and said, "This isn't going to last." And so he turned and looked at me and said, "Can you do this number?" And I said, "Yeah, I can do that number." And he said, "Are you a man of your word?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And I shook his hand, and I came home that night, and my wife said, "So what'd you do today?" And I went, "Not the moment. We're gonna work into this one." So I had to explain to her that we had just bought a cabin, and I've been married for almost 40 years now, and the way you make decisions in a marriage is you don't do them arbitrarily by yourself. And in this one, I did very quickly, but it was a really good deal, and it was going to go away. She has learned to love it, but it's a great story that she's forgiven me for. But I got it recertified as a seaplane base, fixed the amphib ramp, picked up the hangar. I think I've got some pictures in there. I host for 15 years. I bought it, or excuse me, 10 years. In 2015, I started a ski plane flying in the winter because we're always looking for something to do with our skis, ski planes. And over the years, I plowed runways, hosted people. My same gaggle of friends come up and help me, and it's amazing who comes out. Trick Air Skis, the manufacturer of skis, helps me with that, and that's a pretty good deal. So works out well. We've had up to 60 airplanes on the ice on a day.
Wow. Yeah. Now, how is that like? So near me, I'm up outside the Boston area, and there's Alton Bay.
Alton Bay, Lake, yes.
Yep, yep. Lake Winnipesaukee. That if you're really, really lucky these days, it'll ice up enough that they do that. But that's all land planes coming in, you can land there fine on wheels. Maybe not everybody can land there fine, but usually you can land there fine. There's always a story or two.
Yeah, but there's a Bonanza on video that I saw this year that didn't do so well, but that's okay. So
did he go in? What happened?
he looked like he stalled. He looked like he stalled it in over the runway and smacked it pretty good and wrecked it. But ours is Minnesota has a recreational use law, and the recreational use law, best way I can describe it is if you allow a snowmobile trail to go through your property and somebody kills themselves on their snowmobile, you can't be held liable. And so if you're putting something out there for recreational use, you can't be sued theoretically. I'm sure there's lawyers watching that are cringing right now as the ex-airline pilot puts his net worth on the line hosting seaplane event, film at 11. But anyways, we've taken a pretty laissez-faire attitude towards it. The state got on me a little bit and said, "Hey, it's a seaplane base and it's private. So you have to give permission to everyone who comes in." And I said, "Okay." So I have a radio and I say, "You're welcome at my seaplane base," even though my seaplane base is over there and we land in the middle of the lake. But anyhow, I digress. The gist of it is we plow a runway. We put a lot of taxiways in and we end up running out of space at times, and it takes a lot of cooperative. We have a wonderful restaurant on the lake that serves food for us. Trick Air has been gracious enough to be co-sponsor. We've given door prizes out. But the big news is, for anyone who's watching that wants to come up, is the weekend before now, we have snowmobile drag races. And these guys go over 200 miles an hour on the snow. On a quarter mile. These things hook up and go like crazy. But they also need a very smooth, wide surface, which makes a very nice runway. Last year they did it, and it was the nicest ice runway I've ever seen. And it had taxiways, they plowed, they had pits, which is great for parking. And last year our weather wasn't as great. That's one of the problems with ski plane flying is weather, obviously. But we had about 30, 35 airplanes, but we didn't even breathe hard. It was after all the years of me out there in my old beat up red truck plowing, we had a laser ground perfect runway. And this year we're going to do the same. So if anybody wants to come up and see it, I'm not going to run Cirrus people under the bus, but we're very nervous when Cirruses land. We Bush people get very nervous when we see them.
Just tell them to go over the target and pull the chute.
Pull the chute. Yes. But no, it is, you know, it's only a couple thousand feet long. So it's good for 180s, 185s, Cubs, that kind of thing. We've had some people over the years come in with wheel pants, and we've had to take their wheel pants off. We've had people get stuck. We've had all kinds of fun that has gone on, but no one's ever gotten hurt. We had a guy bounce off the power lines a couple of years ago. Don't know how he did that, but he had big black marks on the bottoms of his skis when he came in. It's been interesting, but it has been safe, and it's my favorite thing about aviation. A couple of years ago, we had a guy come in a Kodiak, and the guy came and parked the Kodiak, and nobody wanted to stand by him because I don't know how thick the ice was that time. But anyways, the Kodiak's parked, and there's a beat up Champ with silver on it. This kid over in by Duluth flew in on this thing, and he had straight skis on it. This thing looked like Dolly Parton's coat, man. It had one of this and two of those colors and everything all over the place. And the guy in the Kodiak is standing there just gawking at this thing, and because his first airplane was a Champ. And the two of them sat there and talked and talked and talked and talked. And the guy with the Kodiak, they never talked about his beautiful big airplane. They talked more about the little airplane. So I thought that was a lot of fun.
That's wonderful. Well, I mean, speaking of safety, let's talk for a minute about floatplane flying itself and some of the work that you do at Advanced Flight Training. First of all, let me say, what kind of advice do you have for someone that is not currently a float plane pilot, but listening to this and hearing your stories and thinking that might be the next step in my aviation journey?
First thing is, it isn't a float rating. And it's my story is a perfect example. I didn't get my float rating until literally I bought a block of time in an airplane. I rode with people almost all the time. I flew a lot, did a lot of water landings. By the time I got my float landing, I already probably had 25 hours on a caravan. My best advice is start hanging around the people that do it. And float plane people are, I fly a lot of warbirds. I flew acro for a little while, did those things. My favorite people in aviation are the Bush float plane. When I did my TV show, I love the ultralight people because they were even crazier than we are, but I digress. But the float plane people are so approachable. We have a text group. We're old. We text. And we literally on a Wednesday will go, all right, 1 o'clock, Lord Fletcher's, everybody meet. Boom, 6 airplanes there on skis. And I'm always looking for somebody to go with me. And I bring people with me all the time. I'm not as good as I should be at it, but that's my number one piece of advice. Get in the culture, get around it. And in Minnesota and in other places, Greenville has a wonderful seaplane flying. Fly your wheeled airplane into Greenville. And then just go down to the town and just hang around float people. It's very contagious. The next step, obviously, is getting your rating. And you can do that a couple of different ways. If you have a particular airplane in mind, you can do a little bit heavier float plane, like a train with someone. Or you can do, there's lots of operators out there that train in 180s and 172s. And even there's some 172 amphib training out there. But that's kind of the next step. And then you come into my world, which is advanced flight training, which is advanced float planes and what we're doing at Whip Air and what we're doing with Advanced Flight Training, which is a subsidiary of Whip Air. And what we're doing is trying to bring a more professional product and an offering to people that are investing, you know, millions of dollars in a caravan, hundreds and hundreds of thousand dollars into a Beaver. Literally now that, you know, you take a look at 206s, 185s, look at that market, the haul value of those have come up, and we've got to get the training on even that level of piston to be brought up. And that's kind of why I came on to advanced flight training and what I'm doing there. So I can talk a little bit more about that if you'd like, but
tell me a little bit more about it, because you got this interesting dichotomy of adventure and wilderness and exploration and free spirits. And at the same time, the risk level is extremely high, especially if you're doing the things you talk about, which is as opposed to sort of like city floatplane flying, you know, wilderness floatplane flying. And the stakes are high. So yeah. Tell me how you blend those two, almost two attitudes.
Yeah. So what the first step I did is I went back to what I know. And I'm going to brag on two guys that came before me. There's more people that have worked at Whip Air. But the first guy I flew was Mark Matheson. Mark is probably one of the most talented, consummate, complete pilots I know. Aw shucks, wears jeans, work boots all the time, but one of the best safety pilots. And he was chief pilot of Whip Air before they had a chief pilot. I think they didn't even know what the title was, but he flew everything. And I hung around him a ton, and he taught me a lot. And the second guy is Dale Fehrenbach, and Dale came on, and Dale is one of the best flight instructors I've ever been around. He teaches incredibly well. So I can't compare myself to them. And I came into the chief pilot role after the airline, and what I want to bring in is not to overbear what they brought to the table and what they brought to the training product, but what I want to bring in is what I'm good at, which is standardization and process. And standardization and process, I don't see a lot in general aviation, especially in bush flying. And that is that in the caravan, when I get into a caravan, I treat it just like a 737. And I sat down today, I flew a caravan today, did some demos. I sat down and I start right in the middle and I start a flow. And my flow goes and I check all my switches. I work myself up high. I come back across, I sweep across, I come down, boom, I go to the checklist. Okay, flow, then check. And then when I get the airplane moving, the theory at the airline was, if the airplane's moving, we're not doing anything but moving the airplane. We do all of our stuff with the brakes are set. So if we had to reprogram the FMC, if we had the flight manager computer, if we had to do anything, we stop the jet and we type. We do that and we start taxiing again. And everybody be heads up and we do our thing. We can't do that in a floatplane. So once you're off the dock, you're a missile. You're the consummate moving object. And a Bonanza, a Cirrus, you can pull over to the side just like I did in the 7-3. So the preparation at the dock, the preparation on a lake before you kick offshore or anything like that really needs to be a lot. The mindset needs to be a lot different. And the second thing is that when you're checking things, there's a liftover drag for safety. And that is, if you look down and, you know, you check the trims will kill you. So you need to check the trims, but whether the fans are in off or auto in a caravan or make sure the engine bleeds off before you start. But once you leave the dock, we don't need to be looking at the bleed air switch, and we don't need to be doing that. So what I'm trying to do is take pilots and take them into a flow mentality, flow, do an extended checklist, get the airplane ready almost for takeoff, and then bring it down to three or four items: flaps, gas, gear, and trim. Four things that'll kill you. Flaps you got to have down. Gear's got to be up. Landing gear's got to be in the right position. Trim's got to be in the green. And then you got to have the gas on. You got to have the fuel on so that we don't go. Flaps, gas, gear, and trim. Those sort of things will kill you. So those are the things we want to check. Is the standby power switch on? I don't care. Do you need standby power? Eventually. But for that takeoff in that airplane, is it more important to look down and go standby power switch, auto? And then look up and go, oh my gosh, I'm taxing a float plane across a lake with boats around me. No, let's prioritize safety and let's do those things. The second thing is that float planes have traditionally been taught a lot by the good old FBO chair sitting at the table. Let's get out the sheet and go through the limitations. And then you go through and the start limit's 780 degrees. And then, you know, you can pull, you know, 48 inches of, you know, blah, 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 blah. Now, let's take that and put it into a more modern product. I'm developing a computer-based training program that is aircraft specific for Caravans right now, and with the different variants and selectability. But you'll do that before you come to our training. You'll get the CBT. It'll introduce you to our scenario-based training. And then what we want to do is bring flight instructors on regionally, just like Dale, who's doing contract for workforce now since he's retired, but bring on a lot more Dales and let Paul do what I do, which is I'm not the instructor that he is, but I can run the organization. And then we'll have an instructor in New York, an instructor in Florida, instructor in Seattle, and they will be all advanced flight training qualified, use our CBT, and then use our curriculum. And the curriculum is a lot what Dale's teaching right now based on what he's teaching, because he does a great job. But add the CBT and then add the procedures on the backside of it. And that's kind of why I was brought on, is to bring that in. I'm not the ace of the base. I'm not the bush pilot Mark Matheson was, and I'm not the teacher that Dale was, but I can bring in structure, and that's what I'm doing. So
that makes a lot of sense. You know, I'm curious, based on your airline experience, my very good friend Brian Schiff talks a bit about the fact that, you know, in an airline setting, you don't have all these sort of kind of iffy go, no go situations. You have hard and fast rules.
Right.
About things. You know exactly what the crosswind number is, or you know exactly what minimums are, or you know exactly what it is, and it either one knot one way or another is just a black and white decision about whether or not you're going.
Yeah.
And in regular general aviation, having some of that could probably save a fair number of lives. It seems like in float plane flying and doing things that are putting you into much murkier situations of what's okay to land in, or with wind or wave or anything, right, environment, that's even more important. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
So you're talking about risk management, and we worked a lot on that at the airline. US Air was the original developer of it. In the 80s, they had multiple crashes, and they developed an RRM model, a risk management model. And I want to bring that into float plane flying. And the reason I want to bring that in is because exactly what you're talking about. So let's say I'm taxiing out, and let's say I was in Canada and it's a really windy day, and I'm going to go look at the wind, and it's a bay I've never been in before. And I've got to make that decision. Are there rocks in that bay? Have I been in that bay? What are my risks in that bay? And if I don't know that, then I got to go back to, before I get in the airplane, I got to think this through. Let's do this before we ever leave the dock. And that's where I want to do, is push the decision-making back on the dock. What happens is a lot of guys get everybody in the airplane, a lot of guys and gals, I should say, in this world, get into the airplane and get out on the lake and then start trying to make decisions. You can't do that. You need to get out there and you need to look at those things. So there's risk management. The other is you got to have go and no-go points. And you've got to have go and no-go points on the lake, basically, where you say, if I'm not up in the air by this point, I'm just going to abort. Airplanes will stop quick on the water, but they don't like to fly. They don't like to get out of the water. So have go, no-go points. Those are the things we can bring up in training and push the envelope. The second is that with our training and the structured, as we're training you, we will check you out. We will sign you off. But we will talk about, there are different kinds of float plane pilots. There's corporate guys that fly a Falcon for a business company that has a Caravan. They have a different set of limitations from a 70-year-old guy who's got, used to own a Beaver and have different things. So we want to individualize that, because there's such a diverse population. Standardization at the airline is cardinal. Standardization is impossible in a float plane because every pilot is different, but we want to standardize as much as we can. We want checklists, and we want an RRM model where you're looking at the risk before you leave. And look at, that's just similar to weather, similar to weather decisions non-instrument pilots make. Float plane pilots, because the challenge is many of the guys that have the Caravans have very capable equipment that can fly in ice and can fly in hardball IFR and can do those things. So,
well, I think, standardization certainly across different, different aircraft, different pilots, different things like that. But don't you want... I think if I hear you correctly, you still want to standardize what you're training that individual pilot so that they're not violating their own logical minimums to their ability in their aircraft.
We will have standardized training, but it'll have different outcomes. An aircraft owner that has a ton of Beaver time that is upgrading to a Caravan is probably a good water pilot. A guy who flies a Falcon who just got done at flight safety and is coming to us for initial checkout is not a good water guy. We want to have that real hardcore conversation. We want to get them standardized to a standard, but we also want them to leave with knowing what the risks are. What is the RRM of what you do? You are a very inexperienced float plane pilot. You probably should not land in a crosswind. You probably should brief your boss that, you know, you can only take this much wind, this much water. You haven't flown in heavy water, that kind of thing. Yeah. So just be very honest with those people. Yeah. But standardize as much as we can, but recognize that standardization is not as possible at the airline. But every airplane's the same, and everyone dresses the same and has the same mustache and everything. You know, even our haircuts were similar.
I also want to make sure we get some of the fun stuff also that we don't leave out here. And one of the things, you know, we mentioned it early on, the Hartzell prop that's now on the Caravans, the Yukon propeller that's on those. I've seen some video that's absolutely insane about how different.
Like, I wonder who the pilot was on that. It was insane. I wonder who the pilot was on that. I don't know. We did a video shoot, a photo shoot with the Yukon, and I was just flying the Yukon today. For a lot of our people that aren't Caravan people, they're probably familiar with a Voyager prop. Voyager went on the 180s and the 185s, and it's been a revolution. I liked it because it made my McCulley prop a lot cheaper that I bought, but I didn't put a Voyager on. But anyways, the Yukon is a 15% to 20% improvement, and Whip Air worked with Hartzell. We are the installer for it. It's a game changer. The Caravan used to be not quite floated correctly in the 8000s. They're older style floats. Now we have the 8750. So it floats, it gets out of the water. It does a really good job getting out of the water. The second thing is the motor. The motor was 675, and 675 for that size aircraft was great for FedEx delivering packages, but getting it out of the water was a bear. Now they come with a 114A through Blackhawk, or the EX as a 114A with 867 shaft. The last missing piece of that was the toothpick props that were out there with the Hartzells and the McCulleys were great, again, for flying Caravans in and out of, you know, grass strips or whatever they were doing with them. But it wasn't a great prop. It didn't have a lot of pull. And this thing this is a stump puller. This thing has more pull on it. And you get away with a lot on this airplane. It comes out of the water and boom, it accelerates, which is, you know, one of those things in a float plane. You get it out of the water and you're like, oh boy, it's really kind of, oh, boom, you go right through that. Right away in the Yukon. It's crazy how good it is that way.
You know, it's always funny because there's all sorts of mods and STCs throughout everyone's, you know, history of aviation where, you know, you put this little thing on, you get one knot, you put that thing on, you get two knots, you put all these things on and you expect to get, you know, 40 knots on your plane. And that is not the same thing as watching a video of two Caravans side by side on the water, both gunning it at the same time with two different props, and one of them is left in the dust.
Yeah, it is. It is 15 to 20%. And there's a lot more to that also, because there's a lot more to that, which is it gets on top of the water faster, which means you get more control, which means that you're climbing at 90 instead of 80. Your safety margins just improve. It's to me, it's the best mod I've seen. I love, you know, non subjus dos equispor, which is Latin for there's no substitute for horsepower. You know, there is no substitute for it, but unless you can hook it up, it didn't matter. So it's good.
Yeah. Now, the other thing, when we were at AirVenture, you were standing in front of the fire boss, and I'll bring that up right now, but that is also a really, really amazing plane, and you've just gotten some time in that. Is that correct?
Yep. I just checked out on that this summer. It is, it was interesting. The guy who checked us out said most people go air tractor and then learn to fly floats. And we were float pilots that learned to fly an air tractor, went backwards. And it was interesting. We could fly it. It is, I will tell you though, the people that fly that airplane, the ladies and gentlemen that fly that for forest firefighting, it is a handful. It is a physical airplane to fly. It is big control movements. The wing talks to you, it'll talk to you really nice, but man, do you fly that thing heavy. I've flown heavy float planes, but I've never flown anything like that. That thing fully loaded is a cement truck. And when you get rid of that water, it goes from a cement truck to an ultralight in about a fraction of a second. Really a humbling airplane. Whip has done a great job with it. Bob Whiplinger, it was his dream. I remember at Oshkosh sitting at a restaurant watching him draw it out. And he still has the letter from the founder of Air Tractor that said, please don't do this to my airplane. And Whip did. And hundreds are out, 100, hundreds and hundreds of them around the world fighting fires today, and we all know how important that is. I use the word game changer for the Yukon, but this is a game changer for the Forest Service. This is a small, fast attack aircraft that can work in waves of four aircraft that can do things that other aircraft can't do and put more water on fire and really do a great job.
Wow, it is so impressive. Well, Paul, we've come to the time of the show that we like to call Social Flight's Fast Five, where we're going to take five questions, get to know you a little bit better. Are you up for this?
Sure. You're not going to ask me. Okay. Anything awkward, I'll take the fifth, but okay.
I promise you I won't do anything that's going to be too awkward for you, so we'll give that a shot.
Okay.
All right. Paul Jackson, Chief Pilot for Whitbread's Advanced Flight Training Business. This is your Social Flight's Fast Five. Five questions to get to know you a little bit more. And I'm going to start with something easy, but at the same time, maybe very hard. And that is, you've flown an awful lot of different aircraft that go everywhere from the P-51 to the 737, all your training aircraft, all your float planes that you've done. You know what obvious question is coming for this one. I mean, if you had to pick one, what is closest to your heart out of all of these planes?
Cessna 180 on a set of amphibs.
A 180, really? Tell me why that's the sweet spot.
180 is probably the best aerodynamic, hydrodynamic paired aircraft out there. When it floats, it flies, and when it flies, it floats. And I just love it. I love mine. Mine has got boogers all over it, and you can throw dead fish in the back, and it's just a pickup truck. And it fits my personality really well. If you look really close, my spinner doesn't quite match the paint on my airplane, and I don't care. I like that it goes to Canada and it hums along and does its nice thing. So that's my favorite airplane.
Love that. Love that. All right. There you go. Question number two. Given all of this different kinds of flying that you've done, whether it's been the cargo flying that you've done, being a freight dog, whether it's been the airline stuff or whether it's been the backcountry, was there a particularly striking, scary, or impactful moment in your aviation career that you think you really learned something from that you've taken until this day?
Yeah, and that is that if you love what you do, it's not work. I never had to go to work. I've never been to work. I just go do what I love. So they used to pay me lots of money to run around in a 737 with 44,000 pounds of thrust, and then they paid me a lot of money not to do it because I retired early. It's that if you do something you love, it's not work. And it's very funny. And when you start hanging around people that are not happy, and I hung around them at the airline, and it was always funny when I got in the airplane and I'd start talking to somebody, and you kind of start talking, and then you're like, oh yeah, the guy's like, oh yeah, I'm building a Cub. And you're like, really? What you found was the guy was super easy to fly with, or the gal was super easy to fly with, and they loved their job. And then you'd fly with somebody that was miserable and they didn't like their job. And so I've been lucky enough to mix. That's what I love about aviation is, you know, hey, I get done working at Whitbread, I go fly three, four different airplanes, and I go push my steerman out because the wind's right, and I go fly it because I'm afraid of crosswinds in it. But anyhow, I do that. So the day I quit that is going to be a very sad day, but I love flying. So it's good.
That's awesome. All right. Question number three, if you look back at all the different flights you've had, all the cool experiences, if there were one that you wanted to kind of put yourself right back into, not to change it, to be there, to just experience it again, because it was so great. What comes to mind? What was just a wonderful flight?
My Finney flight at Southwest Airlines. I worked for a very, very great airline, and I had a really, really good chief pilot. And he basically said, how many people do you want to put in the back of the airplane? Not you get five people, not you get 10 people. On your Finney flight, how many people do you want to put in the back? And I put everybody. I had 35, 40 people back there. And we flew to Denver. We deadheaded to Denver, had a little party, and then we flew back. And I flew my Finney flight was Denver, Minneapolis. And I was so proud to show family and friends my airline and my career. And that was really, really cool. I get emotional about it because it was that cool. It was so neat to share that with those people. And that was what I left. Nobody ever got to see what I did. My wife barely saw what I did because we always leave. We just pack our suitcase, we get in the truck, and we leave. And everybody got to see it. I brought my brother-in-laws down up to, you know, when I got the release, I showed them how the paperwork worked. They were fascinated by all the bits and pieces, moving pieces. And it was great because I only had to do one flight. So I had all day to do it. And I basically, Southwest gave me the jet and said I could do with it what I wanted, how many people I wanted back. What a great company, a great leadership, and good people. The flight attendants, everybody on that flight was just spectacular. And it was even funny was the passengers were even that paid to ride, that got the seats that were left over that I got free, were even wonderful on that flight. So that's the one I could go back and do. I'd do it again. That was a meaningful flight.
That is fantastic. Oh man, what a great story and what a wonderful memory. That's really, really touching. I love that. Yeah. All right, question number four. If you had the opportunity to go back in time, give some advice to your younger self, your teens, your 20s, something like that, given what you know now, you've had a pretty good life and a lot more to come. But what still would you tell your younger self?
Marry her, which I did. I'm lucky in more than aviation. I'm lucky in life. Everybody who knows me knows I have completely outkicked my coverage. I have a partner in life and wife who has supported my aviation habit. There's only one entity. My dog hates riding in my 180 almost more than my wife does, but she puts up with it. She draws the line at parachute. She won't put on a parachute and go fly the steerman with me. But if I could go back and make sure I did it right, but if I did it wrong, I would have a way different life. She has been amazing to me, and we have been blessed beyond belief in our life. And I couldn't be happier with her, and she couldn't be happier. Well, I couldn't say that. So
what a lovely story. And by the way, she let you buy a seaplane base. Well, you bought a seaplane base, then told her, then she was okay with it. How about that?
Yeah, well, and same thing with Canada. She found out about that afterwards, too. So, yeah, there's some splaining to do. I'm good at combats. I'm not good at the delivery.
Not bad, Paul. I think you need to tell everybody if she's got a sister. That's impressive.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, and your last question of the evening in Social Flights Fast Five. If you could choose anyone who is either alive or no longer with us, or someone just famous or just someone from your own past to spend an evening with, who would that be?
Hollywood. I'll get emotional here. Everybody has that one guy, and I'm amazed I told all these stories and I didn't mention him, but Hollywood was a F-106 fighter pilot. I lost my brother in 1969. I was only about 4 or 5 when he died. But Hollywood was born about 10 days away from my brother, and I didn't know this for many years. But I was in college, and I was 20 and he was 40 and, you know, a little bit older than me, you know, 17 years older than me. And he had a Piper Arrow and he looked at me and I was going to put it away. And he goes, "You fly?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "We got to get you checked out in this." And what he taught me was, no matter what you have or what you do in aviation, always open the door for somebody. And he came in, he bought a T-28 and flew it into the airport in the 1980s and flew in and gave rides. He'd just flown from Tucson in it. He was just hammered with sweat and oil and every other body fluid you can imagine, just beat up out of him. And he gave rides and he never quit. He gave rides until nobody else wanted one. And I'll tell one Hollywood story. I'll get you maybe the longest Fast Five you've ever had, but whatever. Hollywood and I were and we were in his Beaver, and we flew into town because we're out of beer and eggs. You're always out of beer and eggs at fish camp. So we went to town to get beer and eggs, and mainly because we wanted to go flying. So we took the Beaver, went into town. We stopped at Dairy Queen. And Hollywood walks up and he says, "I'll take a dozen peanut butter parfaits." I said, "Hollywood, there's only 4 guys in camp." And he says, "Ah, whatever. Let's go." I jump in and he goes, "You fly." And I said, "Oh, okay." So I get the Beaver started and we taxi out. Hollywood and I are flying along and he's looking around and we're going back up to camp. And he looks and he goes, "Ooh, land there." And I go, "There?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Why?" And he goes, "Go down there, land right by that boat." We go land by the boat and he goes, "Kill it." And I kill the motor and we come coasting up to these 2 guys sitting in a boat in a remote fish camp. He looks out and he jumps out and he says, "On behalf of the Ontario Tourism, here's 2 peanut butter parfaits." And he hands them to him and he turns and looks at me and says, let's go find somebody else. And we flew around and we dropped peanut butter parfaits off. And Hollywood was the kind of guy who went, "You know why we did that?" And that was to get, because for the rest of their life, they will say, "Do you remember when we were in Canada and we were fishing and these 2 guys showed up in a Beaver and gave us peanut butter parfaits?" That's what we did. John was that kind of mentor. The beauty of it is John wasn't that mentor just to me. John was that mentor to 20 guys, 10 guys, 15 guys, and just a really good guy. Unfortunately, that 106 radar in there cooked a lot of those guys, and he got brain cancer in his early 60s and passed away. And he did, you know, I know you're shaking your head and you're sad, but he also taught me something there. I've never seen anyone die with more dignity and with more grace, and just went through that process. And he taught, even in that, he was a mentor and a teacher. So one of my favorite people. I wish you were here. I think about him often. Tease, we'd always say. I won't tell you what else we always say when we flew into Oshkosh, but he'd always say, wave to the peasants. So we put out taxi. Wave to the peasants, Jackson. Hello, poor people. and we would wave to everybody. But he was a great mentor, and I wish I could have one more dinner with him. And I had lots, but I wish I had one more.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story. That sounds like just an incredible individual. And just hearing that is inspirational in itself. To think like, hey, wow, that's, we can all do a little piece of that somehow.
Always, always, always. What Hollywood taught me is whoever wants to see your airplane gets to see your airplane. Whoever wants to sit in your airplane sits in your airplane. When I go to Oshkosh, I don't put ropes around my airplanes. I will, when I'm not there, maybe protect them a little bit. But I let kids sit in my T6. I let kids sit in my steerman. I put kids up on floats. I get a picture, do this, do that, whatever you can do. That's our job. We got to share it. And Hollywood was so good at that. It wasn't over the top. It was very natural, but he was very good at it. And he taught me that, and I try to carry that forward.
That is absolutely wonderful. Well, Paul Jackson, Chief Pilot for Whip Air's Advanced Flight Training Business, thank you so, so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here. It really is spectacular. I enjoyed spending time one-on-one with you, and I hope you'll come back and share some more stories, because I know you've got about 14 more hours without breaking a sweat that you could share, and we barely scratched the surface.
And come to fish camp, you'll get the unedited versions.
That is going to happen, my friend. Don't go putting an invitation like that idly out there.
All right, good. Well, my last line is fly whip floats. So that's fly whip line floats. They're the best on the market.
Absolutely. And thanks again to Whip Air for making so many things possible, for being a supporter of Social Flight, keeping the lights on here, and allowing us to share stories such as yours, Paul. So thank you again. And I appreciate you joining us this evening here on Social Flight Live.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too. And thanks to all of you for taking time out of your evening and everything that you do for General Aviation and joining us here again on Social Flight Live. We're off next week, but back on September 2nd for a very special show. I got a phone call from NORAD, from Colonel Justin Astro Elliott. They called. They would like to be on the show, which of course I said yes, because they need to talk about TFRs, intercepts, and so many other things going on. NORAD runs the TFRs. There's a lot going on. There's some very important messages from them, and they'd like to use that evening to help us reach all of you. So please join us again Tuesday, September 2nd, here at Social Flight Live. Just go to socialflightlive.com, be here, and that will be a very, very cool show. And then on September 9th, we're here back with our Cockpit Decal show with Brian Schiff. We're going to be talking about Mosaic and what it means to you. And so for that show, you have to register separately. That's Cockpit2Cowl, the number two, cockpit2cowl.com. Be registered for that show. And it's going to be a really, really good time between Brian and I tackling Mosaic. We've read about it, but there's a lot more to dig into. So with that, until next time, I thank you all so much for taking time and joining us here on the show. And I wish you all blue skies.